There was an elderly citizens committee formed here, and the purpose of that was to raise money to build an elderly citizens centre. But we hadn't been formed very long, and we hadn't raised an awful lot of money before the government very kindly came along and granted the full amount of money for a centre, so we became somewhat redundant. I may have been on one or two other committees, I can't remember now.
Can you tell me about the formation of the Historical Society?
Oh yes, the Historical Society. Well, two or three ladies in around Tooradin, Mrs. Banks, Mrs. Ayres, and there was a third lady. Mrs. Metherall. Those three ladies got together and decided that we really should have a historical society for Cranbourne. And they had one or two meetings and created a little bit of interest. They came to me and asked me would I be willing to be the president of the society. Well, I had just become a Rotarian, and as I understood it, one of the things that Rotarians did if they were asked to do something like that, they accepted, and once the thing was underway, they gracefully stepped back and got out. So I said, yes, all right, if they didn't have anybody else to do the job, I'd be willing to do so. And so I became the inaugural president for the Historical Society. But I've never been able to bow out. I'm still a member. But I only did it for the, only became president for the 1 year. There were plenty of other people in the society that were better able to be presidents than I was, really. More capable than I am, really. So when I saw that, I thought, well, that's it. I stepped out, but I'm still a member. Well, the fisherman's cottage came up for sale. Well, we knew it was coming up for sale and decided that it would be a nice thing to have as a meeting place and as a relic of the past. So we spoke to the council about it, and they agreed to pay half the purchase price, and we had to raise the other half. And so we held various fundraising functions and raised the other half of the money, and the council came to light with their half, and we purchased the cottage, and we used it as a cottage to set up as it was in the early days. And we also have not all our meetings. We usually meet down there in the summertime. In the wintertime, we tend to meet up at the Oldshire offices in Cranbourne here. When the council built their new shire offices, they were going to demolish the old shire offices. That was part of their program, but the Historical Society persuaded them that it should be kept and preserved. It's one of the few buildings that distinguishes Cranbourne as Cranbourne. And so the old shire office still stands there, and it's become a meeting place for various organisations, and we meet there. The Historical Society meets there during the winter months because it's warmer. The cottage is a bit cold in the winter.
Just for the record,
how much did you raise for the Fisherman's Cottage? I can't remember exactly how much. I've got a feeling it was 6,000. Now, it could have been pounds or dollars. I'm not sure. And I think we had... They had to raise half, whatever it was. I'm just trying to think how much we raised for the swimming pool. I think we raised 100 and... something like about 130,000, I think, for the swimming pool was our portion. That wasn't half, but that was our portion for the swimming pool. We started raising that when there was only about 1,000 people in Cranbourne, so was hard going. It took us about 12 years to raise it. And we had pretty good support from many of the other organisations around the town, in particular the Rotary Club. But we had a lot of hard-working members who stayed on that committee for the full 11 or 12 years that we were going, raised most of our money or a lot of our money, by catering. We used to take on catering jobs and cater for weddings and cabaret balls and anything that would raise money, really. I remember one of our first jobs in catering was we got a job to cater for a cabaret ball over in Frankston, and we had to hire all the crockery and cutlery and get it onto the site. And when we arrived over there to do the catering, we found that the kitchen had one little sink in a corner. That was the total furnishings in the kitchen. The meal, I might add, was a cold meal. No, it wasn't all cold. I think we had hot soup. I think we probably heated that in an electric copper. Then the meal was cold, with cold salad, meat and salad. And I remember there was a room nearby and a nice, clean, polished floor in it. And we had something like 650 plates spread out on the floor, with aisles between the plates, and two of us going up and down these aisles between the plates. And first of all, with sort of a bucket of beetroot and a dob of beetroot in every plate, and then a dob of coleslaw, and finally the meat, etc., what went on. And that was how we served the meals. And the electric copper was very handy because that was what we heated the water in afterwards for doing our washing up in. We found an odd dish or two, and we had hot dishes of hot water and everywhere, and stuck up on boxes. And it was a Friday night. I think I got home at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning. My wife got home about an hour before me. She got home early. I think I must have missed most of the characters, but there were some characters early in the piece that I've been told about. My wife has relatives who lived in Cranbourne long before I came to Cranbourne. And so they could tell stories about the early Cranbourne, and they tell stories about two brothers who lived on a farm out from Cranbourne and used to come into Cranbourne every Saturday night and go to the hotel. And in those days, I think it might have been 11 o'clock closing. And they had two cars, and they would come out of the hotel at night, and then they would race one another around one of these pine trees. And the result was that every Monday morning there'd be this great groove cut in the ground and all the dirt thrown out as they raced around the car, and then there'd be this circle of earth mounted up around the tree, and the local dayman who used to come into the town and fill up holes and things with a horse and dray, that would be his first job every Monday morning, would be to go back and throw all this earth back into the right and proper place. But not long before I came to Cranbourne, there was a tremendous, well, even when I came to live around this area, it was nearly all dairy, and there was a milk train that used to go to Melbourne every morning. And every morning there'd be a regular retinue of vehicles coming to the station with their cans of milk, which would be loaded onto the train and go to Cranbourne. The train, of course, would pick milk further up the line, and there was also at Clyde, and there'd be the same thing, all these vehicles coming in with their loads of milk in cans. And Cranbourne had the Lady Talbot Milk Farm, which is south of Cranbourne on the highway, about a mile out, and that was the first bottled milk that went to Melbourne. Was advertised as being particularly suitable for babies, and there used to be crates and crates of this milk. That was a very large, I think they milked, it was a very large dairy, I think they milked 300 or 400 cows there. And there was also a lot of onions grown around Cranbourne, and there used to be trainloads of onions go out of Cranbourne. And there were trainloads of sand that went out of Cranbourne from the sand pits. So the Cranbourne railway station was a very busy place. This would be going back into the 20s, and it's a very different story now. Well, of course, it's been rejuvenated with electric trains now, but that's about it. We have passengers and electric trains, and the staff, and the train staff consists of, I think, a couple of people who come on early in the morning. I think they go off about 9 o'clock, and that's the, there's no more staff on the train for the rest of the day, I don't think. Beg your pardon? In the main street?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd have no idea, but they were huge trees when I came here, when I first knew Cranbourne in the early 1930s. They were fully grown trees then, they were monsters, so they'd been planted a long, long while. I wouldn't know who would plant them. Some of the early pioneers, I imagine.
Were they cut down to the
roadway? Yes, they were. They went, huh? That would be somewhere in the 1960s, I think. I'm not too clear on the dates, but I think it'd be somewhere about 1960. We had this new four-lane highway from Dandenong to Cranbourne. When I first came to Cranbourne, or when I first, my first recollections of Cranbourne, it did have a bitumen road, but it was only a single lane highway. But I gather not very long before that it had just been more or less a road with crushed rock on it. In 1934 we had the disastrous flood, and at that time, of course, I was living at home on the farm at Beaconsfield, or alongside the Caninia Creek. We were 4 miles from Beaconsfield, and I can remember the Caninia Creek, of course, overflowed, and I can remember seeing this small trickle of water starting to come down on a little gully that ran through the property, and I can remember seeing it get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and finally, apart from a paddock and a rise at the back of the property, and the rest of the property was almost underwater. Where the house was the water was around the house, not in the house, but it was reaching around the edge of the veranda. And the roads were blocked off. We couldn't go to Melbourne. The highway was blocked at Beaconsfield. Dandenong, parts of Dandenong were underwater. I don't think you could, no, you couldn't get through from Frankston to Cranbourne, from Frankston to Cranbourne. And parts of the Point Nepean Highway were blocked. It was pretty much a sea of water. Kooyarra, of course, was badly inundated. Most of the houses there had 2 or 3 or 4 feet of water in them. During the war, the Kooyarra swamp, of course, was a large producer of vegetables for the war. They grew carrots and onions and potatoes. They possibly grew other vegetables too, but it was largely, no, they largely were occupied growing vegetables for the war, during the war period. And after the war, it was largely seemed to be taken over by asparagus. There's still, of course, quite a lot of asparagus grown down through the swamp. Well, because the land down there was so suitable for growing vegetables. It was, I know we've got a lot of market gardeners here now, but the vegetables that they grew, as I said, were things like carrots and onions, which they didn't hill the beds up for those, they just planted them as a crop. It was a different method of farming to the market gardening that you see around here now. And the land was very rich land, and for things like onions you need strong, rich land. It was ideal for growing onions. Parts of the swamp were peaty ground, which again was excellent for growing vegetables, particularly onions or potatoes. There's been considerable changes around here. The dairy farms have gone, but they have been taken over largely by market gardening, because there's a lot of sandy soil around here which is suitable for market gardening. When it's sandy soil, they can work it winter and summer, which is what they need for market gardening. Of course, this area has developed like all other areas. It's changed. Where we had a butcher, we don't have a butcher any longer, and we don't have a grocer any longer. We have self-service shops. But in the early days of Cranbourne, of course, we had all those things, and we had a dairy. In fact, we had a man in the town, Mr. Ragazzi, who milked cows in the town. And then went round the town delivering milk. You hung your billy out on the gate, and he would come along, and he'd have cans of milk on the back, and you'd leave a note. You wanted a quarter a pint, and he would leave that amount in your billy. So when you wanted your breakfast in the morning, you went out, and there it was in the billy waiting for you. And the baker came round and delivered the bread, and the butcher came round and delivered the meat. And, I beg your pardon?
Anything else?
I can't think of anything else. I can remember Beaconsfield back in the early 30s. I went home to live on the farm in 1932, but prior to that I used to come up to the farm for weekends. And of course it was a very small little village in those days. But we always went to Beaconsfield for our mail and for our shopping. There was a store and a butcher and a news agent and the post office and a little hardware store. And also there was a barber there. There was not much activity in Beaconsfield in those days. There was a hall there. They used to hold occasional dances in it. I think, yes, there was one church there. I think it was a congregational church. I don't know if I can add much more than that, really.